Thanks for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 on your dial. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Christina. How goes it?
Pretty awesome, have to say. Loving the fall transition now. Something new, something different.
In Milwaukee, yes?
Yes, yeah. Yes, I don't know what to say about. I'm actually slowly, very, very slowly. I've been here a year now. I'm slowly falling in love. I'm basically going back to my 20s and hitting the clubs again now that my daughter is more independent. So take that as you will.
Nice, but again, I'm still going to always ask that question about the dryer sheets there.
Oh my gosh, that's right. I do. Yeah, I need to put together a radio show about dryer sheets and other unnatural qualities. Actually, I just hung out with a new friend this weekend, and he had a scented candle. And he's like, yeah, let me light this for some ambience. And I said, hey, let's skip it. It's toxic. I'll send you a link. And that was kind of my running joke for the rest of the night. You know, that's toxic. I'll send you a link.
I love that. A great mantra. You know, that's toxic. I'll send you a link.
No, because seriously, I walk around in people's homes and I'm not judging them. I'm just amazed at how marketing and modern living has convinced us that nothing should smell naturally anymore. And I mean that. I mean, clothes shouldn't smell natural. The air shouldn't smell natural. Your furniture, your body. I mean, everything is scented anymore. And for those of us who almost get nauseous, with it, it's become kind of a thing, and I actually have had a couple of conversations with strangers about it and talked about perfumes in closed situations. Like, you're going to a concert and everybody's within elbow's reach, or a dinner party, or, even an indoor wedding. Is it, I hate to say it like this, I sound like a bee, but is it morally right that we should assume that everyone wants to smell my fragrance for several hours in a closed space where they really can't leave? They've bought a ticket, they've bought a dinner, they're attending a wedding. Isn't that a sort of case where we have to sort of acknowledge, quote unquote, the lowest common denominator? And by that, I mean the lowest possible scent, qualification.
I know. Very interesting. We got an hour right there. Hey, we could just riff on that right now.
I know. I gotta get it ready. Actually, my work has maintained finally. I'm a professional house cleaner now.
Yes.
And I do have some extra time. So I'm glad that we had this little mini conversation here, because I do need to put it on my schedule to just, send you the link.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll just comment on Febreze. Febreze. They used to have unscented Febreze, which was just Febreze to try to take the smell out, but not add anything. And now you can't even find that. It's Febreze is all scented. It's just like, can we just remove the bad odor, but we don't have to replace it with anything.
Right. But then the question for me is, how did you remove that bad odor?
Oh, that's true.
And not have a scent. That's, right. But it's still a very strong chemical, obviously. Mm. And I'm willing to bet, honestly, dollars to donuts, that the reason this unscented isn't on the market anymore is because it didn't sell, is because people didn't trust that it would actually work.
Correct. You got to smell it.
Yeah. Because when you buy Febreze, something has gone terribly wrong.
Yes. Yes. Well, more on this later. Yes.
Yes, yeah, this is a sneak preview. Thanks for coming up with us.
Yeah, so let's talk about the protein leverage hypothesis.
Yeah, so you've got a nice chart here.
I do have a nice chart that everybody else can't see, because I am a visual learner and that's how I like to share things. But the protein leverage hypothesis actually goes back a ways, right? So, and again, hypothesis means that this is an idea that we now have to test. Right, there's some crazy idea or whatever it is, and then we want to test that to see if it's really true and can it become a theory or a law. But the hypothesis is really this idea, here it is, right, that we have strong regulation of protein intake, right, so that we're driven to consume protein. And if we eat not enough protein, we're going to be driven to eat more to make our protein requirements. And this requirement is more, let's call it a gram dosing rather than a percentage, right? We often think about, well, like a high protein diet is 17% of your calories is protein or 20%. But when we're talking about the body, we're really not talking about percentages. We're talking about what is the actual need, right? What is the amount that we need, not the percentage. But then we
And we can get specific with that, right? It's grams per pounds of either your ideal weight or your current weight.
Yeah, you're right. Well, that's the RDA, right? So let's talk about that. Let me finish this and then let's talk about the RDA, because the RDA then sets kind of what we're looking for, how much we quote unquote need. But the protein leverage hypothesis means that we're going to change our consumption, that what drives our eating behavior is the amount of protein that we're getting, but the amount of protein in grams, let's say. So if we need 75 grams of protein a day, that we're going to eat a bunch of food to get the 75 grams. And if we don't get the 75 grams, we'll continue to eat till we get the 75 grams. What that means is that then the carbohydrates and the fats are really the energy part of the equation, and the protein is, let's call it, the building block. And if we overconsume fat and carbohydrates, or basically we dilute our protein, right? So for example, if we're eating something that, typically we'd say the standard American diet is about 15% protein. So let's say we eat more junk food, or we eat more food that has higher fats and carbohydrates, right, junk food, that then we dilute our protein. So now our protein intake, instead of being 15%, goes down to, let's say, 13%. And you say, well, it's only 2%. That's not a big deal. But yeah, it is, because we're trying to get that amount that we were getting from 15. Now we're getting with 13. So we have to eat more food to get that same amount. So the protein leverage hypothesis suggests that we're driven by our protein. We're driven by how much protein we're getting. And what's interesting is protein is sort of boring from a taste perspective, right? I mean,
oh my gosh, yes. Oh. We have to go into that for sure.
Oh yeah, like, totally boring.
How is that?
Yeah, right. So, but still, that's the driving force. So this protein leverage hypothesis says that if we underconsume protein, we're going to eat more, right? We're going to end up eating more to try to get that protein level. On the flip side, if we eat something really, if we're getting too much protein, we'll actually dial back, like we're getting more than we need. So the protein is the driving factor to that.
Yeah, and I would posit, just from my own personal experience the last few months, that it's actually hard to eat too much protein. There's a satiety level, there's a flavor issue, there's a quantity thing, you know what I mean? Like, you could sit and eat a whole bag of chips. I'm not ashamed to say that I have done that in the past. But you're really, if you're eating an entire steak, you needed it. You know what I'm saying? Like, and if you don't eat the entire steak, you don't need it, because you would do it you know what I'm saying? Like, it feels like protein is much more, I don't know how to put it, but like internally gauged than even fat or carbs.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Because it's it's an energy thing versus a building block thing for the most part, right? Energy, like, where are we going to get our energy? And protein's not a really good source of energy in the body. Okay, right? When we say energy, if we're talking biochemical, we're talking ATP, right? Adenosine triphosphate. That's what carbohydrates and fats basically get turned into. That's what's burned in the cell. That's the energy currency, right? So that when we eat a carbohydrate or we eat fat, it gets converted into ATP, and that's basically what it does, right? That's basically, carbohydrates are quick energy and fat is slow long-term energy, right? Now, fat does play a role as some building blocks, right? The cell membrane is made of fat, and we, certainly have fat in our heels, for example, that are super important. That's not like we're storing energy. And then we store energy as fat too. And we store energy actually as glycogen, as a carbohydrate source as well. But really the carbohydrates and the fat are how we choose to get energy. And then protein is going to give us, what do we need to build our body up, right? Because most of what the body is made of is protein. Now, worse comes to worse, we can turn protein into energy, right? If we need to, we can turn protein into glucose. But that's work on the body. Work means that actually requires energy if you're going to now turn protein into energy, right? Kind of ironic. But regardless, so protein can be used in different ways. And it's pretty hard to store protein as fat. I mean, we can. I mean, it's biochemically possible, but for the most part, we never get there. And as you're probably your experience, like overeating protein is super difficult.
Yeah, it really is. So you've just described the pieces of your chart, essentially, right?
Yeah,
you
have more or less.
You have this chart where the x-axis is protein and the vertical y-axis is carbohydrates and fat. And you can be unbalanced and have low protein and high carbs and fat ratio, or you can be unbalanced and have high protein to carbs and fat ratio. But then the middle, the sweet spot, is that you have a balanced protein to carbs and fat ratio that meets. Now, you write the word target here. I guess that's what an individual body needs for daily activities and life.
Correct. So then now we can start to talk about the RDA. Like, so protein is going to be based on, you know, protein is nitrogen, how much synthesis and how much degradation is going on in the body, right? So we're constantly turning over cells and we need more protein to kind of, to recycle the cells and do that. Now, we also recycle the protein, right? It's not like we just break down the cells and we lose all that protein, but we continually lose protein in our urine on a regular basis. So we have to make up for that, right? So whatever we're losing in our urine, we've got to consume. Right, so that's a degradation piece, but the other piece is what do we need for synthesis? So is what we're doing in our life, do we need an increased protein level? Right, so if you play linebacker for a football team, your protein requirements are going to be super high, right? Because you're got a lot of muscle mass, you're trying to build the muscle mass, you're trying to maintain that. That takes a lot of protein. Versus somebody that's not necessarily, you know, as active or that kind of thing, that their protein requirement may be less. But so what's interesting is, so that's an individual. That's completely individual. And so that's like, are you lifting weights? Do you need more protein? But also if you're under, you know, severe stress, if you're burn victims, for example, burn victims have a tremendous need for protein because they're trying to repair that and they've lost the ability to, having the skin impaired and the whole process of that they're trying to make up for something that's been lost. Or even severe trauma, right, can lead to increased levels of protein needed. So it's not just because you're lifting weights, it could be that you're actually breaking down protein as well for other reasons. But anyway, so that's what we need, and that's an N of one that I always talk about, right? Because what you need is different than what I need, and what I need today may be different than what I need tomorrow, yes? So if you're lifting weights today and not lifting weights for the next 2 or 3 days, I mean, you still need the protein, it's turnover, but you understand that this is a constant sort of ebb and flow, and that target is going to change. And how do you know that you're meeting that target? Is it because you're doing some calculation and you put it in a spreadsheet and say, well, this is how much protein I need? I mean, I'm going to tell you, you know, you're hitting your target. Well, I'm going to ask you, right, because I'm a teacher. How do you know that you're hitting your target?
Satiety.
Yeah, of course.
Liveliness. I don't like to use the word energy overly, you know what I mean? Because what does energy really mean? But if I feel like I'm alert and aware and can work, right, because I clean houses and sometimes, I mean, I actually have I don't know how many rooms there are, maybe 15 rooms. I have a 15-room mansion that I clean every other week for 6.5 hours at a shot. And I find, interestingly, that I only eat once during that cleaning, just like all my other homes. And that tells me I'm getting enough protein. Because if I wasn't, I would be eating more. I would have more hunger. And I know this because I was macrobiotic for 30 years and I had a completely different relationship to food than I do now. Completely different.
Yeah, I want to know about that. That's very interesting to me.
Yeah, so with macrobiotics, it was all about making a balance with a wide variety of foods that I can't damn it, right? I can't say, oh, I wish I hadn't done that because I had a child. I raised a child. I mean, I was a full-time teacher. I cleaned houses even at that time. I always had two jobs when I was a teacher. And so I look back and I say, well, I mean, I made that work. Clearly, I wasn't sick very often. And I rarely ever called in to any of my responsibilities. So I look back and I say, wow, I really made that work. However, I ate a lot. And it was, almost all really, really healthy food. I would make bean dishes, seaweed dishes, soups, salads, always a grain, always a vegetable, always greens, very rarely any meat, and fruit, relatively in the summertime kind of thing. And I had, I was kind of famous, whatever, among my friends for making 5 to 7 course meals. Like if there was a dessert, it'd be a 7 course meal. And of course, I did a leftover thing, and I would eat a certain thing and maybe spruce it up. But I would definitely eat something for 3 days before, I had finished the dish. It wasn't like I was making a 7-course meal from scratch every day.
Right.
And I was fine with it, and I had a regular bowel movement, and I had no clinical issues. I mean, to be honest, I haven't seen a doctor, meaningfully since 1997. So, during that whole 28 years, everything was a go. But what I recognized after perimenopause, besides migraines, monthly migraines, was that I just couldn't keep up with all the cooking anymore, and I wanted a new way. And a friend of mine suggested, actually a macrobiotic friend, to do carnivore. And I did that for 2 weeks, 3 years ago. And ever since then, I've included meat in my diet, and the amount of food I've eaten has gone way down. And then in the last month, like since the beginning of August, I've been very protein heavy, just started with protein. And then if I'm still hungry after eating, I will sit down and eat 8 meatballs. That I've made myself. All my food is made by myself, but I'll sit down and eat 8 meatballs, and then I'm like, I'm fine. I'm just gonna live my life now. Like, I don't need to eat anything else, right? Like protein, carbohydrates or whatever. But back to your question of whether it's lean, well, you asked me offline, lean or fatty meat. I'm definitely not eating any lean meat. It's steak, it's beef, it's, well, bison is pretty lean, but I usually mix it with beef because it's a little bit, it's just a little bit different consistency. Like when I make my meatballs, it's half beef, half bison.
Yes, because it's, it's not chicken breast, it's not white fish, it's not these really lean protein sources.
Yeah, I just feel like if you're going to go for it, just go for it. I don't really have a strong hankering, to be honest, for the lean meats. It just happens to be that way. Chicken, turkey, fish, I don't really... I mean, I like what's the pink one?
Salmon.
Salmon, yeah, I like salmon. But at any rate,
higher fat.
I'm eating a ton less. I just made a beef stew actually with carrots and potatoes. And even when I serve myself, I'm always giving myself a big ladle of the meat and then a few vegetables. And I notice that the things that I don't crave anymore, sugar, desserts, snack foods. I mean, I really just don't even have a craving for them anymore. In fact, even caffeinated teas, I don't feel like I need a jolt. I don't need an upper anymore. So right now, it's absolutely working for me. But I did want to ask about flavor. It's like, how can this be the appropriate diet for human beings? It is so bland. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know.
It's so hard. And especially with macrobiotics, it was so colorful. It was so interesting. It was so varied. So I like the efficiency and the satiety of this diet, but it doesn't have the variety, the color, or what I perceive to be the interest that I, the flavor that I had when I was macrobiotic.
Right. So, you know, is this civilization? So civilization is now we cook and we use herbs and we do all sorts of different things, right? We're learning to combine things versus like, I need energy or I need to get something. And what do I need right now? I mean, we can even talk about just eating raw meat as well, right? Cooking was an invention. Right. This was an invention.
Yes.
And that digestion wise, raw meat is actually easier to digest than cooked meat is. Now, does that mean you need to eat raw meat? No, maybe somebody that's got really significantly compromised digestion, that's going to be better. But that may also play a role with just eating raw food in general, raw meat, raw vegetables, raw fruit, this kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
But
I will say that fruit, actually, I don't crave sugar or sweets or desserts like I used to, but I do allow for fruit. And honestly, when I say allow, I'm not actually restricting myself. I'm purely going by what I feel like I need in the moment. And I'm an extremely busy, full-time working single mom. And so I do appreciate the efficiency of it as well, that I don't have to sit around and go, do I feel full? Do I need to make a little rice pudding or some millet on the side? I'm like, wow, I feel amazing. I'm going to go clean this house for 5 hours. Then I'm going to pick up my daughter and drop her off at her music rehearsal. And then I'm going to, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So yeah, it feels, and the way you just described it, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm basically giving in to a caveman lifestyle as far as what I do in the kitchen. It's very caveman like.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And
It
boring.
is. Yeah,
Super boring.
it really is, but it's so efficient and it's so cheap. Like I make vegetables for my daughter. I make side dishes for her, but I don't make a ton because I don't typically eat a lot of it. And honestly, if you're only eating, and I do eat bacon and I do eat eggs. Those are the other two that I eat. I don't eat a lot of bacon, but man, it's really tasty. And I'm like, you know what? It's meat.
Yes.
So yeah, but it's been a very interesting transition. And I, like I said, I just feel like I can do so much more on so much less. I don't know why I would go back to spending more time in the kitchen to make these dishes that aren't, quote unquote, getting me where I want to go throughout the day, you know?
Right. And you have your right barometers in place, right? So you're listening to your body, and your body will communicate to you when you've had enough. And that's the
Yes.
target. And that's what we're not used to in this culture. And this is what gets hijacked as well. This is what the food industry hijacks because they know that too. And it's the way. So how do we bypass that? How do we bypass the natural satiety that we find from the diet that we eat to encourage people to eat more, quote unquote, junk food, right? And for the most part, that's fat and carbohydrates. Now, I can't say that's not, right? I mean, the prevalence of protein powders and protein bars and all this kind of, I mean, it's all over the place, right? I mean, high protein diets, eating higher protein is very popular right now.
Right.
Yes. And this isn't keto either. This is different than keto. Because let's be clear about ketogenic. The ketogenic diet actually limits the protein. They want you to eat more fat because you're trying to be in ketosis. So being in ketosis, honestly, I don't care about because that's a test. You do a urine test or you do blood test and you say, oh, I'm in ketosis. I need to be in ketosis to lose weight. Well, okay, you're in ketosis, but you don't necessarily have to be in severe ketosis to lose weight, right? It's what you're doing over the long haul. And if you eat more protein on a quote-unquote ketogenic diet, you'll pull yourself out of ketosis. So that's this drive that we're eating high fat, high fat, high fat, high fat.
So you'll pull yourself out of ketosis. I have to
Yes, you
break here
will.
and say, I have to break really quickly and say thank you again for
Go.
tuning in to WDRT 91.9 on your dial, listener supported radio. You're tuned into the Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rettay and Christina DeRocher. I feel like I should actually say Dr. Paul Rettay and
Oh, great.
Christina
Thank
DeRocher.
you. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I felt that way the first time I said it. And I was like, you know what? You can say something different this time. It's okay.
Fantastic. So, but again, right, it's all about this how much we're getting from energy, how much we're getting for, building blocks, and that's the balance point. And protein is remarkably satisfying. Even though it's boring, it's satisfying. The satiety kicks in. And really, when we look at satiety, it's protein and it's fiber that are the most satisfying foods. Satisfying means you eat them, you feel full, you don't want to eat anymore. Right? So
Right.
this may be the benefit of the macrobiotic diet, a vegan diet, something along those lines, where you're eating a tremendous amount of fiber, and that'll have an effect to also kind of cause satiety. And I think that, people following a whatever, a good, well, I think macrobiotic, you're going to be good anyways because you're following the rules. But, vegan, you can easily be on a crappy vegan diet. Yes.
Yeah, Oreos are vegan. I have to say,
Exactly.
in the midst of this, because my spiritual father and I are the ones who have jumped ship from macrobiotics and are really on this meat kick. And one thing that he has heard through the grapevine is that when the Japanese men who brought macrobiotics to the United States from Japan in the 60s, when they brought it, they were thinking about sustainability and regenerative practices, even then, about the earth. And some have posited that even though they knew that meat is more has a higher satiety and a higher protein, and therefore would be a good food stuff for people, they were thinking about the fact that it takes, 100 gallons of water to make a pound of beef versus a
Yes.
hundred versus 10 gallons for an acre of rice. And don't quote me on that, but obviously it takes a lot less to sustain an acre of grain than it does to sustain a pound of beef, water-wise, and also then the land that you need for your cows versus the land that you could use for grains. And so actually through the grapevine, I've heard that it could have been meat if they felt like it was more sustainable for humanity, because that's one of macrobiotics' huge takes on the world, is that one grain, 10,000 grains, it has to feed all the people of the earth. We have to be aware of our brothers and sisters and not cause any suffering. If you eat 5 apples off a tree, that's selfish. You probably only needed one, and now you've taken 4 away from others, that kind of idea, So that was interesting when somebody told me that. I was like, oh, they may have actually picked grain as the centerpiece, just more from a regenerative standpoint. And of course, we know in 2025 now that that's not actually true, that the people who are bison farming now have recognized that the hooves are placing nitrogen back into the soil, that
Yes.
raising cattle is actually extremely regenerative.
Right. And this is from Japan too, correct? That's the genesis. And Japan is an island country, and actually the meat that they're eating is fish, because that's what they have an abundance of. So that's a completely different geographical situation, and how many people are living in Japan, how do you feed them compared to the United States, where we're vast and we have, we're not an island at all, right?
Very good point, actually. Very good point. They do also have that whole dictum of, you eat for your destiny is what they would say. So
Yes.
again, if you're a secretary versus slinging tires for a living, that you're going to have, they would say you would eat more yang, but that would probably mean more grain
Right.
than vegetables, for instance, right?
Right. So fascinating. And think about it too. So animals are concentrating the protein from the plants that they're eating. So when you eat an animal, you're eating a much higher concentration of protein. So if we just go back to the protein leverage hypothesis, if you're only eating plants, you have to eat a lot of plants, just like you said, right? With the macrobiotic, how much food were you eating to try to get that protein level that you needed?
These macrobiotic conferences, we would lay out all of the dishes. We had to make a serving of each dish for each person because we knew nobody was going to skimp. They were, excuse me,
Yes.
full dinner plates, somewhat mounded. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And as opposed to, like I said, the other day for dinner, I just put 8 of my homemade meatballs in a bowl and just was munching them while I was talking with my daughter over dinner. And when I was done, I was like,
I'm
I
done.
think that's it. I think I'm just going to get on with my night and go to bed in a few hours. And I was just so, it just continually surprises me. I'm like, wow, I could have a mound of grains, vegetables, beans, greens, soup, and a little, soy milk dessert or something like that. Or I could have 8 meatballs and be on my way. I mean, it's like, wow.
So again, think of that as concentrated nutrition. So it takes a lot more resources to concentrate that nitrogen, to concentrate the protein to do that. Is that good? Is it bad? But then also, how much do we really need if we're eating the concentrated protein? And then on top of that, what's our activity level, right? So it's all these things that are going into determining, when do we stop eating? And that's what the goal is, right? Is not to tell people, well, you have to count your calories, you have to record everything. Isn't it just freedom to just say, wow, this is all I need, I'm satisfied, I'm done? So
Yeah, and I watched something the other day and they were suggesting protein powder and supplements and some herbs and things like that. And I was texting with my spiritual father, who's also on this kick, and I said, do you fool around with any of that? And he said, if you look at the actual, really down to the brass tacks of what is included in meat, it's really all there as long as you have variety in your protein intake. I mean, if you're eating real meat, off of an animal, so to speak, you don't need those supplements. Me, unless you're bodybuilding, maybe, right? Like if you need
Yeah.
to go over because you're building more muscle than is normal for a human being of your activity level, then maybe you would fool around with those. But his point was, it's all there. So I thought that was really interesting. But here on your sheet too, I see that you have a whole litany of the dangers of high protein diets.
Right, right. We got to look at it from both sides. That's what I do, right? I'm a skeptic. I don't want to like just do something and say, oh, that's right. Like, what is the other side of that? But let's go there. But before we go there, let's just talk about the RDA for a second. Right. So how much protein do we actually need? And like I've suggested now, this is an N of one. So this is going to be based on the individual, what's going on with them, how much protein do they need? And then we get caught up in the RDA, right? So RDA is the minimum amount that we need to prevent protein malnutrition. That's really what the RDA is, right? We're preventing disease. We're not optimizing health. We're preventing disease. And that level is, you know, technically 0.8 grams per kilogram of ideal body weight. So whatever your ideal body weight in kilograms is, and then you calculate 0.8 grams per kilogram. And that comes out, roughly speaking, to somewhere between 45 to 55 grams of protein a day. So if we look at that and we say, you know, that we're, you know, we say, well, we don't want to eat meat and meat is excessive and we don't need to eat that much, we tend to look at the RDA and say, oh, well, that's the optimal amount. It's not the optimal. It's the minimal amount. So that's where we start.
It sounds like about half of what I eat. Again,
yes,
as a professional house cleaner, I eat probably, I eat twice as much as the RDA then.
Yes. So again, this is where we have to be careful about just using numbers to guide us, right? Mm-hmm. Or just saying, and understand that the RDA is a minimum rather than an optimal. And the optimal is going to be something that you're going to need to figure out yourself. Yes. So.
And when I started, I was really paying attention to the things that I already had from macrobiotics, which was excellent sleep patterns, you know, general good energy throughout the day, minimal sicknesses, a bowel movement every day, you know, like well-formed,
yes,
not excessive urination or too little urination. And I noticed that things pretty much stayed the same. There was a slight, you know, change in bowel movement in the very beginning, of course, as my gut was getting used to a complete 180. Because of course I don't do anything subtle, but other than that, and that's of course righted itself. And other than that, there's been no other issue. And I actually feel like I have more clarity in my mind and more energy throughout the day. And again, it's really helpful for me. You know, I charge city rates as I'm cleaning houses here in this big city. I can't afford to be eating a 5-course meal at any point while I'm working. And certainly not, I can't be sitting down twice in a shift. You know, like I need to, you know, bring what I need and, you know, munch it down. I'm not even hungry until 10 o'clock in the morning. That's part of the problem. So I do have to eat when I'm cleaning sometimes. And that's why I keep referencing meatballs, because they're super easy to eat on the run.
Yeah.
But yeah, I noticed that, you know, that same N of one, it's like you can look at your health markers and say, are you moving laterally or up or down from what you had before if you increase your protein?
Oh, yeah.
And to me, that's more meaningful than, you know, grams per kilogram.
For sure, for sure. And again, you can achieve this in many different ways, right? And we're humans, we're omnivores. We've adapted to be able to digest fat, to digest protein, to eat plants, to eat animals. And, you know, we spend a lot of time fighting about that, like you should be doing this or you shouldn't be doing this, instead of saying, you know, maybe it doesn't matter, but let's really try to look at the quality of the food that we're eating, perhaps, and how does that affect our satiety or hunger or energy? I still like to use energy. I use that term all the time, even though, yes, I know that it's like, what do we mean? But I get your point. But that's what we should be paying attention to, right? And so, you know, like a ketogenic diet, right? I still like a ketogenic diet is a very valuable way to balance your blood glucose quickly. But honestly, it's too much fat for the most part. And I think that following a ketogenic diet and being in ketosis is sort of not necessarily the long-term goal. Being on a ketogenic diet and saying, wow, when I take carbohydrates completely out of my diet and I feel better and I balance my blood glucose, wow, there's something to this. Now let's try to figure out how I eat a sort of a mixed diet and get that. But that mixed diet may still be, well, maybe I don't need as much fat. Maybe I can eat some carbohydrates that I don't have to eliminate them, but I really need to work on trying to figure out where that protein level is. And or using fiber as well, right? So again, there's the value of fiber that you'll hit satiety, but understand you may hit satiety, but you may not be making your protein levels, right? So this is just a question that I have. So somebody that's, you know, not getting a dense source of protein in there, they're eating more food potentially to get the protein, but is the fiber sort of in the way that they actually may need more fiber? I don't know if that's your case, right? Because when you went carnivore and ate meat for 2 weeks, like that made a huge change for you, right? And it's not like you were unhealthy, but like there was still something maybe missing, correct? That there's just sort of, you needed that density and trying to figure out like what's the balance between those?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had an iron deficiency. That was the issue. And for 2 weeks, it absolutely worked, only meat. And people said that I had this aura of She-Ra, you know what I mean? And I felt it. I mean, I think I was only sleeping 5 hours a night, which yes. Now would worry me. You know, like I don't want to just sleep. I mean, I'm fine sleeping 5 hours a night, but I need seven, you know, and that's actually right. Changed. I used to need eight, you know, but yeah, it did work for 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden I said, you know what, I'm going to make some rice pudding for dessert tonight. And I made some rice pudding. And the next night I was like, I'm going to have some more of that rice pudding. And then the next day, when I was making Annalena's, you know, vegetable sides, I said, I'm going to have some of those baked carrots. And I went, oh, this is what I'm doing. I didn't even really think about it, but I was expanding what I needed, right? Like all of a sudden my body said, why don't you have something besides meat today? Just a little something extra. It's fine if you keep eating the steak, but let's add a little bit to it. And so I feel like I'm doing that organically now as well with my daughter around, because she doesn't want to eat as much meat. She's still eating more meat than she did ever, you know, because I raised her macrobiotically the same way I described myself eating for the last 28 years. But when I make the dishes, the side dishes, I just have whatever feels right. And it hasn't been an issue. I feel like if I was not eating enough fiber, again, I would see it in my bowels. I would see it in my, you know.
I think that's somewhat of a myth. I mean, I think fiber improves bowel function. Do not get me wrong. I think there's a lot of value to that. But I know plenty of people that eat very little fiber and they have regular bowel movements. And I know some people who eat a lot of fiber and don't have regular bowel movements. So
really?
It doesn't cause it, right? But it's a contributing factor to that. It's all about digestion and peristalsis. And are you engaged on the upper end and this kind of thing, right? Because people, you'd be like carnivore diet. How are you having a bowel movement? You're not eating any fiber.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right. Think of that. I mean, if you're not eating any fiber and you have regular bowel movements.
Right. That's true,
not
actually.
From fiber. But I would say your digestion is engaged. You're working from the top down, right? I mean, that's how I look at it. Are you producing hydrochloric acid? Are you digesting fat? Are you engaging on the upper end? And then the peristalsis, right? The muscular movement in the GI tract is just working. You don't necessarily need fiber to cause that to happen. Fiber assists that and helps that. But it doesn't cause it.
Got it. Interesting. Okay.
Right. But I mean, because that's the thing. We think, oh, you go on an all meat diet, you go on a carnivore diet, you're never going to poop. That's just not true.
Oh, see, I never heard that, and I never had that experience. So my bowels got loose in the first 24 hours.
That's very typical. Very typical. Loose. You'd be like, oh, wait, I don't have any fiber. We need fiber to poop. You don't need fiber to poop. You need a properly functioning digestive tract.
Yeah, I guess I've had that since birth then, because I don't think I've been constipated a day in my life.
There you go, right? And you've done different things. Yes?
All kinds of standard American diet for the first 19 years, macrobiotic for 28, and this weird, you know, meat-heavy carnivore-type thing for several years now, really.
Yes.
Or I should say meat centric. I'm going toward the heavy, but I don't think I was doing heavy for the full 3 years. You know, for a while I was going back to almost like a standard American diet, but more like living off the land kind of thing. Like anytime I go to a restaurant, I would get the meatloaf and potatoes and green beans. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So, but can we talk about the dangers? Because I thought that, you know, at first when I saw this in your printout, I was like, oh no, I should watch that. But actually, and I don't hope I'm not giving it away, but almost all of them are a little bit like, they're very, very specific, or they're very, very not worrisome almost.
That's correct.
Yeah. So I was very surprised by that. And I think it's worth going over for people.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that. And maybe we come back, or maybe we just need to do another, maybe we'll just do the next, we need to do a two-parter on this, probably even do a three-parter on this. But you want to do a station break? I think now is a good time.
Okay, yes, I can. I was waiting 3 more minutes. I had it in my mind. Thank you so much for tuning in to WDRT 91.9 on your dial, listener-supported radio. You are now enjoying The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher.
Yeah, so the dangers. What's the problem with a high-protein diet? Well, first of all, if you have kidney disease. So the kidneys play a really important role in filtration. So it's filtering, and the one thing that it's filtering the blood, and one thing that the kidneys do is it holds on to protein, right? We should not see protein in the urine. So protein in the urine is not a good sign. That's something that tells us that the kidney filtration system's not working so well. So somebody with kidney disease is already going to have that, right? So they're going to be spilling protein into their urine. So somebody that has kidney disease, the treatment is to be on a very low protein diet, right? Because protein is going to exacerbate that. But you're exacerbating an existing condition. So that's completely different than somebody that has healthy functioning kidneys. So having healthy functioning kidneys, eating more protein doesn't necessarily lead to protein or to kidney disease. It's that you've got the kidney disease, right? And now we're trying to, put things together to say, hey, how do we take that pressure off the kidney? I think that's the same thing even when we talk about hypertension or salt intake, right? Now I'm digressing a bit. But salt, right? I mean, salt is like a public enemy number one. It causes high blood pressure. Everybody just needs to eat no salt. But how many people overconsume salt if we're looking at, again, RDA levels? In the United States, like everybody eats more salt. And how many people have hypertension? Not everybody. So,
Right.
but when
That's
you eat more
amazing.
salt, you hold on to fluid, you can't get your rings off there, and that's going to increase your blood pressure. But that's sort of just episodic, right? You'll eventually urinate more and you'll balance that. So if you have healthy functioning kidneys, you'll be able to balance that yourself. You don't have to worry about it. So for the most part, and with hypertension, there's people that are salt sensitive, right? Tends to be blacks, but there's, the sort of that subtype that those people really respond to going on a low sodium diet. And then, I don't know, 80% of everybody else doesn't have that problem, but yet we tell everybody to do that, right? So it's sort of same guy. I mean, I digress completely, but the same thing here is if you have kidney.
It's another good point. N of one weighed against your actual condition and or experience.
Exactly. But we make it to be all, high protein is potentially problematic. Anyways, it is for somebody with kidney disease. Bone and calcium balance is another one, right? So the deal here, and we've seen that in people that eat, like all meat diets, that type of thing, is that we'll see more net calcium loss in the urine. Right, so now you're starting to lose calcium. So what happens is that your body will use calcium in order to buffer the acids that are formed from eating meat, right? So eating meat, and not just meat, there's other foods too, right? But that's this kind of the acid ash hypothesis, right? So that we're really acidic and we're going to use calcium in order to buffer that acidity. And yes, the way the pH works in the body is that when we have acid, we need to buffer that. But understand that if you're alive, you're producing acid. Acid is the byproduct of being alive. And yes, meat and some other things are more acid-forming than perhaps some vegetables, but the whole idea is that we're going to buffer it, and calcium is a potential buffer, but it's not the only buffer in the body. Right? So, for example, potassium is another buffer, potassium bicarbonate, right? So there's other things that we can use as a buffer there. It's not just calcium. So perhaps it's not. I'm sorry.
And potassium, bananas are very high in potassium, right?
Correct. Potato skins too. Potato
Because
skins,
that's a fruit
tremendous
that I
amount.
crave that I never ate in macrobiotics because it's not local and it's never seasonal. I mean, maybe in the summertime, but interestingly, bananas are what I want to. I have a smoothie with avocado and a little bit of oats.
Yes.
When I clean houses, that's a good energy boost, right?
Yes.
But banana is in it, and I really like bananas
So,
now.
and now, so potassium will act as another buffer. And understand that sodium and potassium are, if we look at the periodic table, you remember the periodic table of elements.
Yes.
And the really important thing on there are the columns, right? Not the rows. So, columns. So, elements that are in the same columns. they share the same number of electrons in the outer shell. That means their binding potential, how they're transported in the body, is very similar. And sodium and potassium are in the same column. And there's a pump that we run on all our cells called the sodium potassium pump that maybe I've talked about before. This is like second day of physiology, right, in medical school. We learn about the sodium potassium pump. And the sodium potassium pump uses up 30% of the energy in our body. One third of our energy is used to maintain these little pumps that we find on all our cells. And basically that pump just pumps potassium into the cell and pumps sodium out of the cell. So it's exchanging potassium for sodium, right? So sodium, potassium. So that it's that ratio that's super important, right? And we get worried about a high sodium diet, but what we don't get concerned about is a low potassium diet. And potassium doesn't even have an RDA. We have an adequate intake. So adequate intake is, well, this is what we think that you need. But we don't even have an exact level. And actually in the United States government with the Food and Nutrition Board has lowered the adequate intake on how much potassium we need. But potassium is super important, but potassium is inside the cell, sodium is out of the cell. There's this exchange that happens, and why we do that is it sets up an electrical gradient across the cell membrane so that we can contract muscle and relax muscle and do all these things that couldn't happen. So all of life is driven by the sodium-potassium pump. And so, again, sodium, I never worry about the amount of sodium we eat in our diet, but potassium, oh my gosh, you know, maybe not deficient, but insufficiency across the board. So how do we increase potassium? And basically eating more fresh fruits and vegetables are going to do that. So again, the idea that we're going to use calcium, we're going to leach our bones because we're eating a lot of meat, it's possibly, wow, maybe if I eat a little bit of a mixed diet, or if I just eat some fresh food, right, some fresh, you know, vegetables, and honestly, even eating raw meat, you're going to get more potassium than cooked meat if you think about this. So think about cooking meat. What happens when you cook meat? It shrinks, yes?
Yeah.
And what are you doing? What's it shrinking from?
Heat.
Yeah, well, heat is causing the shrinking. Shrinking means you're losing what from the meat?
Nutrients?
Fluid, right? You're losing fluid. You're losing meat juice. Yes, so meat juice comes out when you're cooking it. Now, if you braise, understand, you braise and you cook it in water, you didn't lose any of that. That just gets put into the broth or whatever you're cooking it in. Whereas if you're grilling or you're broiling or you're doing something else, it's shrinking. You're losing the fluid in there. What do you think is in that fluid?
Potassium.
Oh, my gosh, yes, because it's inside the cell. Same thing in an animal. It's not any different in an animal than a human as far as the sodium-potassium balance. So again, this is the idea that we overcook our food, or how we cook our food may then influence the amount of minerals that we're getting. So braising is better, or again, like I said, if you're going to eat it raw or something along those lines, yes? So just keep that in mind, that that's something we lose. Also eating meat too, that should we eat all parts of the animals? Because our ancestors ate all parts. So our ancestors didn't get scurvy on an all-meat diet. Why? And the French trappers that were in the north...
Yeah.
We've talked about this, haven't we?
Yes, yes. The eyes and the liver.
Yeah,
and the heart.
Eyes and the adrenal glands. Eat the tissue behind the eyes, eat the adrenal glands. There's vitamin C there. So again, eating a muscle meat diet, you may end up with some issues. But if you eat all parts of the animal, like our ancestors did, guess what? You're covering all your bases.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how it is, right? I mean, it's like we somehow think we're civilized and we cook and we use certain parts and we do this and we're like kind of losing. We're losing it. I can give you many examples of how we see nutritional deficiencies that never happened before the industrial production of food.
Wow.
It didn't happen in native culture. Now, granted, we don't really have, you know, exact data that they didn't have it, but what we see from anthropology records and that kind of thing is we don't really see that. And then we see pellagra and all these things happen in the southern United States after, you know, around the Civil War and after the Civil War, as we start to industrialize food and change things, right? We humans get involved and we try to change it and preserve it and concentrate it and do this kind of thing, and we end up sometimes messing it up. That's where, again, my skepticism is there, that I tend to trust what have humans been doing for a long period of time.
Yes, yeah.
Instead of like, what's the new novel food item that we can eat? And we did not eat protein powder.
No, we did not.
It
It
didn't
was
make
not, I
sense.
mean, we weren't able to produce it. I mean,
No.
what do you even make protein powder? I mean, it boggles the mind when you
Well,
think about
whey protein, and they have beef protein, and they have pea protein, and they have whey. Well, whey is dairy. All these different things that they're concentrating, but there's a market for it, right? Wherever there's a market, you're going to see a product for it.
That's right.
Right. So
That's
again,
right.
the drive is, oh, I got to add protein powder to everything. And if you do add protein powder to everything, you can get your protein levels up high, right? That's one way to do that. But if you're eating real food, it's very difficult to do that. And I would
Right.
argue in your case, you're probably still eating a very high fat diet and not, I mean, you're still getting protein, but you're not eating, 60% of your diet, your calories as protein. I'd argue if we measured that with you, it's probably 20, 25%, maybe. You'd be surprised. Most of it's fat.
Really?
Yeah, well, but if you're eating chicken breast and white fish, then you would be getting, then the protein would be higher because there's not as much fat in there. That fat really dilutes the protein a bit.
You know what's interesting, though, is that I've never felt fitter, and I'm speaking as a perimenopausal woman who gained 20 unmoving pounds 7 years ago. They're not going
Yes.
anywhere. They're still here, and I feel more fit, and I have lost my gut in doing this, even in the few weeks that I've been doing this, because I'm eating so little comparatively.
Right. And again, what do we care about? Right? Losing fat. And we get concerned about weight, but understand weight, when you step on a scale, some of that's water, a lot of it's muscle, a lot of it's fat. And we can't really tell by stepping on a scale, like, what did we lose? So we go by like waist circumference and, biceps circumference and that kind of thing to trying to get some gauge of that. But again, how do you feel? Right.
I
So
know.
I think that's really the key point instead of trying to measure all of these things. And don't get me wrong, we can measure things, but let's not get caught up in the measurement. Let's get caught up in how do I know that this is working for me? If you go on a ketogenic diet or you go on a macrobiotic diet, like I don't care. It's just like, but how do you feel when you do this? And how many diet trials are out there that actually ask people how they feel? None. Zero. We do a weight loss trial, the goal is weight loss. No, the goal is does somebody feel good that maybe they could actually sustain this diet for 20 years? Because that's what we need to do. Because we do
And
a
so
weight loss trial for a year or 2 years, it's telling me nothing that you can con somebody to follow a diet for a year or maybe 2 years. It's really difficult. I mean, conning, you know what I mean. I mean, it's just like we give you this diet to follow, and that's, that may not be real life. Real life is like, wow, I feel better, and I'm going to try to figure out how do I maintain this? And what's my leverage point? And I'm going to argue it's protein and or it's fiber.
So another danger, though, of high protein diets that people think about is cardiovascular, getting back to your lipids.
Yeah, right. So part of that's then the lipid hypothesis thing, which has nothing to do with the protein, right? Just because you eat animal protein, now you're getting more saturated fat. That's a bad guy. I think that's a myth. I mean, I think we've talked about that before, but that's certainly, I mean, that's on the table, right? They'll say that. But again, eating lean meat won't do that. I mean, you could eat lean meat, and then we've got to say, well, then that doesn't play a role in it. So that's really not the protein. It's what's associated with the protein. And understand, you eat wild, grass-fed beef, you eat wild salmon. I mean, I've actually just figured this out, that when you cook wild salmon, I cook it at a lower temperature than I cook farm-raised salmon. Well, I never eat farm-raised salmon. So I'm eating wild salmon, and it because there's not as much fat in it, the temperature needs to be lower. I cook it to 120 degrees, whereas farm-raised salmon, they often say, well, you're cooking it to 125. And I find that makes a huge difference. But keep in mind, I like sous vide stuff, and I geek out about like exact temperatures on things. But trying to get that salmon and not overcooking salmon. I mean, maybe how easy it is to overcook salmon. And again, wild salmon, 120. So again, because it's the fat content, actually the fat content is lower in wild salmon than in farm-raised salmon. Same thing in a grain-fed animal versus a grass-fed animal.
Yes,
Right? So
right.
this is all just different composition based on what we feed the animals or we feed the fish. But regardless, so your diet, I mean, I'm still going to argue it's maybe 20% protein, 22%. I don't know, right? I mean, we could do that calculation, but a lot of it's from fat. So again, you feel good. And is it because you're eating the protein, or is it because, and where's the energy coming from? I'm going to argue it's coming from that fat that you're eating with that.
Yeah.
Because you're not eating lean.
And that's why when you asked me offline, you know, how do you feel between lean and fat cuts? I knew I was going to tell you, which is the truth, that I'm not attracted to lean cuts, and I don't feel like I'm sluggish with fat cuts. And I would, like, my mind would tell me, oh, you're eating, like, you're surprising me by saying maybe 22, upwards of 22% protein, but actually what's giving me the oomph is fat. That surprises me, but it also doesn't even worry me, because I'm saying, okay, well, then, you know, whatever you want to call it, how I feel is, yes, keep doing this.
Yeah,
right?
It doesn't matter. We don't have to calculate that. It's just that you'd be surprised that you think it's like 50% protein, and it won't be. I mean, 25% maybe. But let's flip this script a little bit. So there's also something called the protein-sparing modified fast. So the protein-sparing modified fast is most effective weight loss strategy of all the diets that are out there, is a protein-sparing modified fast. So what is that? Protein-sparing modified fast means that, and they've done this trial numerous times, but the classic one was done in the mid-80s, outpatient. So they took people that were overweight. Now, these are people that have a lot of weight to lose. And they basically put them on a lean protein diet. So they're eating very little, no carbohydrate, and they're eating very little fat because they're only eating lean meat. Okay, so now understand, so they're eating, you know, maybe 600 to 700 calories of chicken breast, white fish, turkey breast. That's what they're eating. You think your diet's boring? This is even more boring.
It sounds like it.
Oh, super boring, right? Super boring. But here's what happened. Yeah, go ahead.
I have to say, we're actually at time.
Maybe we
want to start with this in our second one.
Yeah, let's do that. So let's just state what we're going to start with. So it's a nice thing. So we're going to talk about the protein-sparing modified fast.
Yes, and we're not going to forget about the burden on the liver. I want you to talk about that, too, as a possible danger.
Yes.
Thank you so much for tuning in to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Ratay and Christina DeRocher. See you next month.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.